everyone, and welcome to Orphaned Entertainment, the podcast dedicated to public domain media. I am Christopher, and with me today, with shovels in their hands, ready to dig into this month's topic, is Lydia and Barry.
Welcome
hey. Back.
I want to make Aloha. The sound effect, but I feel like it'll be really bad. It's like, shh, shh. That's the shovel digging.
Is that your shovel? Okay.
That was my shovel.
I like it. I can see that.
Hey.
It is great to talk to both of you again. Barry, it's fantastic to have you back with us.
Yay,
thank you.
Barry.
A pleasure.
Oh, I'm so excited. Yay. Not that I don't love talking to you, Christopher, but it's always fun to have somebody else on.
Oh, absolutely. No, it's always fun to have Barry on because I think he certainly brings a lot to this podcast that, you know, I'm not going to say is missing if he's not here, but let's say added to.
Yes.
It's like an extra helping.
Well, thank you, guys, and I guess we should say off the bat, maybe we should lower expectations because as we learned before the podcast began, I saw the wrong movie this week.
Yes, there was.
But
it's at least the same story.
Same story, same writer, completely different decade.
Oh, and we will get into that shortly. I guess that is as good a time as any to go into like a short break where we will hear a brief promo from another fine podcast, and then we will cautiously climb down with Quatermass and The Pit.
How to continue a television series after a major actor has left the cast. Part 1. The Quatermass Method. Simply recast a new actor in the original role. Hope that no one notices that a familiar character now looks completely different. This was also famously used in the James Bond films.
For more about British science fiction television, listen to the British Invaders podcast at www.britishinvaders.com.
All right, well, welcome back, everyone. We are going to discuss Quatermass and The Pit. Mostly, we're going to discuss a BBC production, which originally aired in December of 1958 and January 1959. Barry, I think we'll be able to chime in a little bit with, I think it was a 1967 film?
A 1967 film, distributed by the Hammer Movie Studio. You know, when you sent me, I think you did send me the link. I'm pretty sure you did, but I thought, oh, he doesn't want me to watch a 3-hour movie. Come on, there's no way. He wants me to watch this 90-minute movie in color from 1967. Of course he does.
Yeah. Oh, yep, my mistake. No, I went for the big guns here.
All right, well, yeah.
Well, it's interesting. It's actually a version of the film that I'm very interested in seeing because I'm, of course, a big Hammer Studio fan. And I don't think I have seen the 67 version, so that will definitely be one that you'll have to send me the link to the one you found so I can watch that yourself. Because I believe that one is also it's in public domain. It's certainly out of print as far as I know.
You're absolutely right. It's out of print. It's very good. And it's only half as long as the version you saw.
No, Christopher, now I'm curious because we're talking about Hammer Films, and I am really confused because maybe it's because I started watching the first part of the 1967, but I thought that the one we watched, the miniseries, was also Hammer Film. Is that not accurate?
No, it is not. It was actually produced by the BBC.
Oh, well, that explains. Okay, so I saw Hammer Films, and I thought, oh, of course, Hammer. Well, it's because I'm like halfway between both of you, so this will be
interesting. So you kind of saw a little bit of both. Barry saw the 67, and I only saw the 58-59. So, yeah, this is going to be a really interesting...
I did see all of the 58 and 59 one, but I did see about maybe 20, 30 minutes of the 67 one. So
okay, very
that
cool.
Explains my confusion, at least.
All righty. Well, the 58-59 version was the third and last of the BBC's Quatermass serials. The first serial, the Quatermass Experiment, is sadly lost to time. There's only, I think, one or two episodes remaining that you can still find. The rest is just gone.
Now, I have a question about that, and this is
sure.
Maybe something our readers would be willing to look into. Now, and this is kind of unrelated, but a little bit, you know, me and my tangents. So there are... Let me try that again. So while we're watching the series, it occurred to me, of course, that it's a lot like the original Doctor Who serials, which started in 1964, so around the same era. And what I was curious about, now, what you've seen a lot with the Doctor Who ones is they've gone back and animated them. So you have the audio version is still, they still have those, and so they've gone back and animated it. I'd be really interested to know if the Quatermass ones are, if anybody's looking into doing the same for the Quatermass, if the audio still exists, if they go back and animate it.
Oh, that'd be so very interesting. Yeah. No, I don't know.
It's a great
idea. Yeah, it is a fantastic idea. I don't know if the audio exists or not. That is the case with a lot of these, that the audio remains separately from the film. And I don't know if that's the case with it or not. It would be very interesting to find out. And if anyone has attempted to do any kind of flash animation or anything to go along with it,
well,
or production stills, that sort of
thing. Yeah. And I think that these series lend themselves to even radio broadcasts. They're very similar because it's a different era. And so there tends to be a little bit more exposition, even by the characters, than there are in modern movies and modern series.
Absolutely.
So you can, often they'll say, what is it? It's a, giant metal thing or what. So it might actually be producible. Take it from that perspective.
Absolutely.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, I think the Doctor Who comparison is absolutely spot on because the Quatermass films have always been about big ideas, lousy special effects, which is why there is so much exposition, because obviously there's so much you can explain and make, sound ominous or eerie just by telling in the form of a ghost story. But you're absolutely right. I think animation, visualizing these extraordinary ideas would really, it might even enhance it in a way they didn't even have the opportunity to back in the 50s and 60s.
That is true. And it's interesting, the ones that I've seen, not to go off track, but the ones that I've seen from Doctor Who, I think they try very hard to stick to the actual storyboard that either still exists or that was in the original filming. And so, if you could do that with the Quatermass, then you could fill in a lot of gaps that otherwise would be lost to history.
Yeah. The second serial that was simply titled Quatermass 2 is still available and is also in public domain here in the United States. But that one is actually kind of regarded as the lesser of the three serials. I think actually the one we're discussing tonight is regarded as one of the best science fiction television
Well, definitely a pioneer, I think.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Chris, and thank you for chiming in about that. Let me just throw this out. I mean, I've been wanting to see this for the longest time. I've never seen it before, and I appreciate you assigning this to me to check it out. For John Carpenter is one of my favorite filmmakers. John Carpenter has been quoting Quatermass for years. Really quickly, let me just throw this out really quickly. One of my favorite films that he did is called In the Mouth of Madness. Well, The Fog is good, but In the Mouth of Madness takes place in a town called Hobbs End. John Carpenter's The Thing and John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness have scientific, well, pseudoscience in lieu of horror that's very much like Quatermass. There's so much of John Carpenter's work that constantly references the Quatermass film. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, it almost seems like it has like this cult appeal. Like it never really crossed over into the mainstream, at least not in America. But in terms of its importance in the genre, I mean, I completely agree with you. It's always struck me that I always felt left out. Like, well, I need to see these films. Like, clearly, they're so influential, they're so important, but I've never encountered them before.
Yeah. Literally, you brought up the Doctor Who. That was the first thing I thought of while watching this one, is this has to be – I don't know if anyone's actually ever come out and said, but I think this has to have been a huge influence and probably inspired Doctor Who. I mean, Doctor Who came 10 years – not quite 10 years, about 5-6 years after this particular serial. The Quatermass stories are some and we'll get into this one – some extremely intelligent and heady science fiction topics. This one in particular is a topic that I don't think even Doctor Who, I can't think of anything that even touches it, at least not on screen, until maybe getting into the 60s and certainly not into the 70s.
Yeah.
There are some interesting cross-examinations is not really the right word. It's interesting how they take some crossover with this, because you have a very, very science fiction kind of element in this, but then they also take it on, I hate to use the word, but a religious or a spiritual aspect, and they cross them over, and they question how much the one influences the other, and I love that.
Yeah,
I don't think I've seen in anything where they usually, you sort of see a degradation of one or the other. you either see them talking down to science or talking down to religion, but this is interesting, or spirituality rather, I think is a better word for this. But in this particular serial, they take both of them and they kind of say, well, we argue that, you know, people have a tendency to argue that the one is true or the other is true, but isn't it possible that they're both the same thing, just described differently? And that's probably way ahead of where we're at in the podcast.
Yeah, we will definitely get into this a little bit more as we go into the plot.
Yeah, but my point more is that it really seems cutting, not, I hate to even say cutting edge, it just seems just new, unique, something that you haven't seen before, especially not before this era.
Exactly. Well, before we get any further into the plot or anything, we should mention about a few of the actors that appear in this serial. And Barry, I'm interested to hear, I actually don't know who stars in the 67 version. In this particular version, in the 58-59, as Professor Bernard Quatermass, is André Morel, who was an accomplished actor who appeared on stage and screen from the 1930s to the 1970s. You might recognize him from films such as The Bridge on the River Kwai and Ben-Hur. And he's been in several Hammer Studio horror films, a little another connection to the 67. He did a few of them through the 60s.
One of the best stories ever, The Great Train Robbery. I love it. Lord of the Rings, the 1978 version. I just had to throw those two out there because I was the most impressed with them.
Who did portray Quatermass in the 67 version, Barry?
I'll be honest, it's not the guy you mentioned, and I don't recall his name. In terms of movie stars that you would recognize in this film, I was kind of blown away. And this is it's ridiculous, but once I realized this actor was in the movie, it kind of blew my mind because I'd never seen him in anything before. Julian Glover plays Colonel Breen. Julian Glover was the guy in Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. He's the guy who sipped the holy cup at the end and melted in front of our eyes. He was very young in this movie. He plays, I guess you would say, the nefarious Colonel Breen. And he actually meets a very similar fate at the end of this film as well.
Oh, very cool. Andrew Keir is the your Quatermass and
yes,
the Hammer.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, and he did a fine job.
Had to look it up real quick there since I brought it up.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, he's very good. I mean, the character is kind of like he's kind of like Bill Nye the Science Guy crossed with Robert Langdon, I think.
All right. Very cool.
That sounds pretty similar, actually. Okay, maybe that's a stretch, but for some reason. Yeah, I think the thing that reminds me so much of Doctor Who in this is that Quatermass and the one that we watched, the 1950.
Let's call it the BBC version.
Thank you, the BBC version. He sort of knows everything.
Yeah, true.
And so I think that his character, and he is an older character, not old, but, you know, it probably I would estimate in 40s, 50s. He just kind of knows everything. And that's, you can see again, I think, I don't even want to speculate, but. So I'm just going to end that sentence with that.
All righty. Well, alongside Andrew Morel is Cees Lindner as Dr. Matthew Roney. He is a Canadian actor that appeared in many, many productions on both sides of the Atlantic, and you might recognize him from a few things if you're familiar with this film. He certainly, it was one of those actors that he seems really familiar that I know I've seen him in something, but I'll never be able to figure out what. The last actor of note, and since Barry brought up the Hammer version of Colonel Breen, is an actor by the name of Anthony Bushell. I believe is how he says it. Bushell or Bushell?
Bushell.
Bushell. Again, another prolific British actor who unfortunately passed away about 5 or 6 years after his role here Quatermass in the Pit. And yeah, Julian Glover on the Hammer. Well, now I definitely have to go see this one because...
Yeah, it's good stuff. I'm looking forward to hearing your
Barbara
assessment.
Shelley, too. Wow.
Oh, yeah? Nice. I was going to say, I look forward to hearing your assessment of the special effects in your film, because the version I had, they're a lot of fun. I mean, clearly, we're talking about a low, low budget, but really fun, really imaginative special effects, but I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah, well, I think we'll have some similarities between the two. I don't know what Lydia thought, but the BBC version, I thought, for what they did and how they did it, I think their special effects, they pulled them off a lot better than I think it would have been really easy to fail at. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, for the era, I think that they're respectable at least.
Exactly.
There are a few bits in this serial that, frankly, are really creepy.
Yo, absolutely.
This is not this, especially if you bear in mind the era and the fact that that England had just come out of World War II, and seeing the for lack of a better word, the mania that had gone on during that period. This is a very, very creepy story.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the last thing I should mention, I skipped right over it before we get into the synopsis at all, is that all three of the Quatermass serials and all versions of the Quatermass, including The Hammer, were all written by Nigel Neal, who was a very prolific and award-winning screenwriter. Did a lot of work for the BBC, and then his work was, of course, adapted for in the Hammer films and all this other. So definitely look him up. I'm going to guess that he's written... If you're a fan of any of the any British serials or movies or whatever, I'm guessing you might find something that he had his hand in.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. He's one of these really intellectual writers in terms of kind of an Isaac Asimov caliber writer, combining ideas with science fiction. Unfortunately, the first time I ever heard of him, it's really strange, but it's a John Carpenter connection. He wrote the original draft of Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, and apparently he was so disgusted with what they did with his screenplay that he had his name taken off the movie.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, now I have to jump in here, and I had no idea until just a minute ago that this was the case. Apparently, he was the writer in the original 1980s version of The Woman in Black, which,
nice.
By the way, creeped me out far more than the newer one. Not that the new one was not creepy, but the original one, I watched it thinking, oh, I'll watch that. It won't be so creepy. It's the 1980s version. I was terrified. It is so creepy. And I had no idea this was the same writer. So thanks for bringing that up, Christopher.
Oh, absolutely. So I definitely recommend going and digging up some more works from Nigel Neal. I know I will. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, to get into Quatermass in the Pit, we'll start in the BBC version with episode number one, which was entitled Half Men, I believe. We are at Hobbs Lane, a building construction site in Knightsbridge. And the crew, while digging a new foundation, I think they were doing, they discover a skull in the mud in one of the big scoops.
It's a skull, all right.
It's all bashed.
You reckon he's been murdered or something?
No, it's all, fossilized, like stone.
It must have come up with me last lot.
Must have been down there a long time. Maybe hundreds of years.
Hundreds?
What are we going to do with it?
Here's the gaffer.
What's going on here? What's the stoppage?
He's found a skull.
Careful.
It's real old, ain't it?
Looks it.
Reckon we ought to report it. Do a museum or something.
That's right. Like them Roman remains.
Oh, no. The trouble of the works held up.
Listen. This could mean something good for all of us.
That's right. Yeah.
Let's get on with it.
All right. Jack, you stay here and see that nobody messes it about.
This is something that they do where I really love how they kind of explain a little bit of passage of time and actually tell a little bit of story just by passing over some newspaper headlines on the street. Mm-hmm. Where apparently time has passed and that scientists are now excavating the site, finding these bones. And I think they actually say that the several ape men have been discovered at Knightsbridge at Hobbs Lane.
And now the 1960s version starts off pretty similarly. I think they're digging a tube tunnel,
mm-hmm,
as opposed,
okay,
to, yeah, a building foundation. But you still have that same iconic imagery of the skull in the mud. And iconic. I hate to use that word.
No, that works. And it absolutely works. But you know what? They call it Hobbs End in the 67 version. And something weird I want to point out, this is almost kind of a non sequitur, but just go with it here. The 1967 version opens up with this really nice panning shots, leading up to Hobbs End, so you get a sense of the mood, the town. There's a cop who's walking across the street. It's kind of a foggy day. And we see this ominous cat crawl across the screen, and that's an old trope, having the cat go as it walks,
yeah,
past. But this is a white cat. I've never seen an ominous white cat in a movie before.
Well, we are then introduced to Dr. Matthew Roney, who is leading the expedition to, or the archaeology expedition to uncover these bones, and he's holding a press conference.
The idea of calling this press conference hasn't entirely met with official approval, has it?
Oh, really, Dr.
But to be blunt about it, I'm counting on your help, and through you, that of the public. Now, as you may know, I'm in charge of the archaeological work at Hobbs Lane in Knightsbridge. We've been there now a week, and I'm worried. We need time to do our work properly, and I'm afraid we're not going to get it. The owners of the site want to get on with their building. Now, that's natural enough, and they're pressing us to get out.
Oh, that was confidential.
Oh. All right, please keep it off the record, gentlemen, that they're trying to kick us out. But if they do, they may wreck one of the most remarkable finds ever made. Now, I've made statements that these fossils are important. Now, I'll go further than that. I believe they are of unparalleled importance. They may teach us more about our remote ancestors than we've ever known. I believe they're of vast age. I believe they will show that creatures essentially resembling mankind walked upon this earth between 3 and 5 million years ago.
Mm-hmm. You have to make way for progress. I mean, you know, when a building has to be built or a tube has to be dug, it's just, you know, all of history and all of that, it doesn't matter.
Even if that history, even if these fossils are perhaps as old as 5 million years, Lydia?
Well, when you put it that way, it just sounds like it's going to hold up the digging. But that is the attitude that they take with it.
In the 1967 version, I wanted to point out, when they unearthed the fossils, I was curious what it was like for you guys. In the 67 version, when they unearthed them, we're seeing skeletons that are clearly of the high school science class variety. They're all clearly, you know, together, and it's a very inexpensive special effect.
Oh, that's a shame. No, the BBC version, they do a fantastic job of doing they find a skull, and it's partially crushed, but it's still stuck together by the mud, and then they find a couple little, you know, a tibia, or, oh, here's a vertebra. Yeah, they're very good about what it's really like to be digging in the mud and trying to find these fossils. They're scattered. They're bits and pieces. They're fragile.
Yep.
Yeah, they did a really good job keeping it very grounded in reality in the BBC version.
Exactly. Very good.
Well, Professor Roney, or Dr. Roney's assistant, Barbara Judd, wheels in what a likeness that she has created from some of the fossils. They were able to assemble a partial, not a full skeleton, but a partial.
Now, I love this. I have to interject here. Mm-hmm. I love this. They do a similar thing, I think, in the 1960s version, where they say, well, we don't know what it looks like. And they say, well, we have an idea. And then they unveil reconstructed skeleton. And it always makes me laugh, because we kind of run into the same thing here in the Denver Museum of Natural History. We're all aware that the Tyrannosaurus Rex is missing one of the tailbones, I think it is. You know, but I love it that they're like, oh, here's the skull and here's the tibia. Let's just stick them together and, oh, here we go. They must be like 2.5 feet tall. But, oh, no, we've been digging here for 3 weeks, and now we already know, you know, kind of what we think they look like.
Yeah, it might be a little bit of a stretch, a little bit of a jump, but it was still
artistic
very
license.
Effective.
Yeah, I think it's artistic license is what they call it.
Yeah.
But I think in the 1960s version, they actually have like a – they actually have them like made out of clay, like so you can – they speculate that he looks like an actual primate. Is that accurate, or am I mixing the two up?
No, you're right. It's funny, too, because you get the sense they do this discovery, and there must have been this guy just, like, working on this for months going, look what I got! I have this! So he, like, brings it forward pretty quickly. There's a lot of props in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they do, I think it's pretty much both of them. Yeah, what they come together is they have the facial features and everything kind of created, and that's the kind of technology that didn't really exist until maybe the 80s, going into the 90s, when you're talking about the facial reconstruction based on a skull and being able to tell, you know, where the muscles attached and that sort of thing.
Well, it's the holograms now, the holograms, you know, where, oh, you can reach out and grab a part of it and move it. This technology does not exist.
Right.
But in the movies, they always take that license and they always say, oh, well, it's, you know, maybe the government's hiding this technology from us. But it's definitely – I think you're always going to have that ahead of its time technology.
Oh, absolutely. And You know, and it's very effective in this case because it does exactly what it needs to do. Exactly. But the point is, this fossil that Roni has is an upright ape man. Unfortunately, though, his findings are met with some amount of skepticism.
Well, you know, he's a anthropologist.
Yes.
Nobody really believes those guys.
Paleontologist or whatever, I think they say. Inflection's quite a little different. Even he admits to some of his colleagues that he jumped the gun a little bit. He probably said too much too soon. He was really worried about losing access to the site. And so, yeah. Well, about this time, a gentleman comes up and to say hello to Mr. Roni. It turns out this is Mr. Quatermass.
Quatermass! Annie, how are you? Well, fit enough. Todd, eh? Harassed by publicity?
Oh, harassed by not getting enough. You know, about a week ago, I was a retiring sort of creature. Now I behave like a press agent.
Oh, well, sometimes you have to do it. Get public support.
I have to now. I said far too much too soon. I'm wrong.
Well, if you're wrong, it won't matter, will it?
I'll just retire. They'll stick me right alongside the Piltdown forgery as a horrid warning. Well, Quatermass, it's been years now. What are you doing? Still buried out at your rocket research place?
Oh, I'm just up for a conference at the War Office.
War Office? I thought you were strictly, a civilian outfit.
Oh, we were.
Good heavens, they've taken you over.
Well, if I say so, I'll be infringing the Official Secrets Act. But it seems we have to move with the time.
I'm sorry, Quatermass.
I love this part. It segues into, eventually we get to a part where he's actually at his meeting and he's talking to the chiefs of staff or whatever they call him. Sorry, British people, no disrespect. I always get this wrong, but you know what I'm talking about. He's talking
the minister
to the
military. And his staff, yeah.
Thank you. And at some point they say, well, let's face it, within the next 10 years we will colonize the moon.
Yeah.
And I love it. It's the 1950s, and they're like, within the and that's
and possibly
so,
Mars.
Well, yeah. And it's so indicative of that era. I love it.
Yeah.
That was a period of time where people were really looking out to space, and obviously the moon landing happened in the 60s. Am I right? Please say yes.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Thank
right.
you. So the moon landing happened in the 60s, and everybody's thinking, oh, and then from there things are just going to shoot off, into the sky, and we're just going to move on and. We're going to take over the entire solar system. Of course, that didn't happen. But I love going back and seeing this. In the 1950s, they're saying within the next decade, this is going to happen. And it makes me a little bit sad because now we're kind of at a point where we're like, nothing's really going to happen for the next 30 or 40 years. But I do love that little moment where they say, all this is going to happen. And so we don't want to turn this into a military thing. It has to focus on peace. But it's a little bit sad that we didn't colonize the moon in 1968.
Yeah, just a little bit. I'm glad you brought up that scene, though. That moment, that actually the entire scene within the minister's office while they're having their meetings and, Quatermass is trying to discuss, they're all coming in going, I think we're all ready. We just need to sign the papers and,
It's such a political – I think that at the time – especially, again, considering the history, he's saying, look, we've already been through this war. We know that within the next 10 years we're going to be facing this. And if we turn this into a military operation again, all we're going to do is create more wars. And you see so much of that time period that we as, our younger generation that weren't around during that time, we missed it. We don't really understand the concerns. But I love how they bring that into, especially you see it in the BBC where they bring in the real issues of the day. I suppose you see it in American stuff too, but definitely in the BBC, you always see some kind of a political angle in it, and you really do here.
The setting up of permanent bases on the moon, and possibly Mars also, is a certainty within 5 to 7 years. Those bases will be military ones. The present state of world politics leaves no doubt about that.
So there's a race on.
As usual, there is a race on. Whoever plants those bases can police the Earth. Ballistic missiles will be stored there. Slave missiles, designed to react automatically to activity on Earth. Even if an aggressor nation should totally wipe out a neighbor in a nuclear attack, they would themselves be obliterated by missiles from space. That is the concept of the dead man's deterrent.
You really believe that missiles could be so accurate?
They could locate the Earth.
And destroy everything on it.
We should not have been the aggressors.
Oh, no, no. But you'd send the whole of humanity up in smoke to avenge ourselves.
I take it that greater accuracy in these missiles would be a constant object.
Of course, sir, yes.
The absolutely ultimate weapon.
A sword of Damocles would hang over the head of any aggressor ready to fall.
We might call it Operation Damocles.
Good. Yes, yes, good idea.
Stop this. Ultimate weapon. Can you really pretend to believe in such a thing? There never has been one and there never will be. All this means is that from the very start we'll be going into space with one thought, war. We're on the verge of a new dimension of discovery. It's the great chance to leave our vices behind us, war first of all. Not to go out there dragging our hatreds and our frontiers with us. Gentlemen, we must not lightly agree to this plan. We have a right to express our opinions, to advise against it. I implore you.
It's a really great scene, and it is a very political scene, and that's something that I really appreciate about this entire serial is that it is not just always strictly science fiction, or it's not always strictly fantasy. There is some really great drama. There's a little bit of dry comedy. There's a little bit of everything throughout it.
I feel like that's really unique to British television. I feel like that's not something that you see in the U.S. I feel like that you, when you're watching science fiction in the U.S., it has to be strictly science fiction, and it's not strongly political. And if you guys want to argue this on the Orphan Entertainment page, please feel free to do so. But I definitely feel like in the UK you see a little bit more of that reality, a little bit more reflection of the reality that's going on.
That's interesting, guys, because the Hammer version doesn't have any of that. And it's not to say that it doesn't have any kind of social commentary, but it's on the one hand, I mean, just to talk about in terms of what it is, in terms of being a reflection of its time, the 67 version does not reflect the mod culture. It doesn't reflect the growing flower power culture at all. So it doesn't have any sense of it being, you know, a movie set during its decade. But in terms of what you're talking about, too, you know, which I really love, too, that notion of the optimism in the space program, there's none of that either. Your version clearly has a lot more plot than mine.
Interesting. Well, something had to get lost to bring it down to those 90 minutes.
That's right, exactly.
All of Quatermass's arguments kind of falls on deaf ears, and in the end, it is going to happen. The military is taking on his rocket group. He gets to stay on as director. Loosely, by his fingernails, I think, but he gets a new military partner. With a Mr. Colonel Breen.
I feel like I should go dun dun dun. Dun, dun, dun. Breen, dun dun dun.
Well, back at the dig site, one of the volunteers that's doing some digging gets a bit of the migraine as she's digging through the mud, and she discovers a smooth something in the mud. It's not a bone. It's not another fossil. They think at first it's maybe just a water pipe or something, but it's extremely smooth. And unfortunately, Barbara has a rather nasty thought, is that perhaps what they're looking at is an unexploded bomb. So
again, I keep coming back to the time in this history. I love it. I mean, that's so of the period. You're only a decade out, maybe less than a decade out from World War, about a decade out from World War II, and these things existed.
Well, they decide the best thing to do is actually call the bomb crew and have it checked out. And of course, that pretty much puts a stop to all the digging. We do meet a Captain Potter, who is the head of the bomb crew.
They basically, how I read this, tell me if I'm wrong, they had to get a young, good-looking guy in there.
Oh, well, sure. Of course.
I mean, he is the young, good-looking guy in the entire serial. It's just him.
Well, and you gotta
I'm not saying the others are hideous. I'm just saying he's obviously the one that they cast him because they needed a young, good-looking guy.
They needed a young, good-looking guy, and they needed somebody with sort of maybe they can have a connection with Barbara Judd there.
Exactly.
With the assistant.
Yep.
Well, Captain Potter is immediately suspicious of this quote-unquote bomb. Because he tries to put his little stethoscope, which is apparently magnetic, on it, but it just slides right off. Can't figure that out. So it can't be any kind of metal. And they decide that the best course of action is to continue uncovering the object. Well, as they get started, Professor Roney goes off to find Quatermass to get a second opinion. To see if he can...
identify the bomb, I think.
Well, to see if he can get it, if he has any influence with some of the military to kind of speed things up a little bit. So he meets him up at the minister's office there and asks him. And Quatermass, of course, manages to coax Colonel Breen into having a look and seeing what he can do. That's another fine little scene. I couldn't quite figure it out. As he's talking to Roney, Breen is in the office. You can tell he's kind of listening in. He's overhearing the conversation. And when Brony asks Quatermass, he's like, well, come on, can't you ask somebody? And Quatermass is like, military. You see kind of Breen sort of perk up, and he starts to walk out of the room. And I couldn't figure out if he was trying to walk out of the room so he couldn't be asked or if he was just kind of hoping he would be asked.
Well, and I kind of got the impression that Breen is there almost as a plant. Like, the military is there to make sure that their interests are covered. And so they bring Breen in to make sure that Quatermass doesn't get his way of making it, you know, keeping it completely peaceful. They want to make sure that this belongs to the military. And so I felt like for Breen, his entire focus is to make sure that the military's interests are pursued in this situation. And so I don't have a conclusion for your speculation, Christopher, but that was kind of my take on him. Is he just wants to make sure that they're capable of going to war if they need to.
Right. I definitely think that's his motivation, certainly at the end. I was just in the actual meeting or in the conference room.
Yeah, as to whether he's actually that is a good question. I sort of felt like he was trying to get asked, but that's my personal perspective.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to know, I have to ask Barry what yours was.
Of that particular scene, or?
They didn't even have that scene in the 67 version, did they?
I don't believe they did. No, again, I think they just chopped away all the needless parts. Like, let's just get to the monsters. So, yeah.
That's a shame.
It was the 60s. This was the era of the blob.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, Lydia, because I wanted to address this, because your comment earlier really had me thinking, because you're right, because on the one hand, when it came to science fiction, certainly when my version came out, when the 1967 version came out, you had Rod Serling's Twilight Zone and you had Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek, and they were making social statements, political commentary, yep. social Fantastic. Commentary, like in really radical ways that science fiction can do. But you're absolutely right. When it came to movies, even when your version, even when the BBC version came out, you have, you know, rare examples like, you know, Robert Wise's The Day the Earth Stood Still, things like that. But you're totally right. At this point, science fiction was kind of stuck with, you know, rubber monsters and atomic monsters and nuclear monsters.
Yeah, it was more about the thrill than it was about the speculation, let's say.
Yes, yes. Science fiction being based on ideas was kind of a rare thing, or the ideas were really gimmicky and corny and usually involved, you know, the atomic age.
Well, back at the site, Quatermass, they start digging around and they're uncovering this object, and Quatermass questions Roney about where the first skull was found.
Roney, where did you say the skull was found? Where exactly?
Well, in the earth that's been dug away, 2 or 3 feet above his level. That's right, isn't it?
Yes. It was here.
Zeppa.
Why? What's wrong?
Well, if it was above this thing. Roney, tell me again, how long did you estimate that skull had been there?
Something like 5 million years.
5 million years.
Are we only at part one?
This is only the end of part one. There is a lot that happens in this
there
first part.
There is. Well, and there's a lot that happens throughout the entire thing.
True.
And honestly, I would say that each segment has its own almost standalone theme. Not standalone from the perspective that it carries on from another story, but each segment carries its own theme and really kind of examines one specific idea of this entire storyline. So, in the first one, you're talking about the discovery and about making sure that it doesn't just go to war, that everything's going on isn't just focused on war. But then at the end of it, it's all of a sudden, it's not about war anymore, because this thing that we are thinking is an unexploded bomb is behind, it's below something that's possibly five million years old. Then if you're watching it as a modern person, if you're watching it now, you're going, well, duh, I know what that means. But at the time, again, you have to go back to the 1950s, and they're giving that extra exposition because in the 1950s, archaeology is not the word I want, but that wasn't as widely known. I mean, you have to think about the fact that Tutankhamun's tomb was only found in the late 1920s. And so this is a relatively new concept where we've had, almost 100 years to look at archaeology and, understand how, well, one thing buried under another means that it's older. But at that time period, they had to explain it. So I'm really getting way too in-depth in this, aren't I? But again, it's one of those interesting things where, yes, they end it with that drama and they say, 5 million years and it was underneath, and they have to kind of pound that idea home. But it is, at the time, I'm not aware of any other films that had begun to explore this concept of sorry, guys. I feel like I'm just dragging on and on. You're like, get to the
no,
point.
No,
already.
No. No, you're doing great because you're bringing up some really good points. You're bringing up good points, Lydia. You really are. I mean, like, even today, like, this is a rarity, in science fiction to have ideas. I mean, like, we could talk about, Christopher Nolan's Interstellar. We could talk about Ridley Scott's Prometheus. But even today, science fiction driven by ideas is rare.
It is.
What I really appreciated with this one, and a lot of the sci-fi and the sci-fi and stuff at the time, or just films of this time, is that nothing is handed to you on a platter. Quatermass is forming thoughts. He doesn't have all the answers right away, but he's forming thoughts,
yeah.
And we're watching him form these thoughts. He's just thinking out loud. He's not coming up with the solutions.
Yeah.
Nothing. It's the audience isn't sitting there. Oh well, we know what's going to happen. We just have to wait for our characters to catch up. You are along for the ride with this entire story. You will never know more than the characters in the film do.
Yeah, and that is the rarity today.
Very much.
You know so much more than the characters do. It gets almost exhausting, definitely exasperating. But back in this era, everything, and I love this with the serials, because with each episode, you find out something that you didn't have in the previous episode. So the first episode starts off with, you have these skulls, these bones. And then the next episode, you find out, now we have this cylinder, this thing. This object that is buried down with them. Oh, and you can go inside of it. and every serial, you find out something new that you didn't have the previous episode. So yes, it's a little bit drawn out. It's a little bit long, but if you have the patience, then you really get to see a lot of the inspiration that we now take for granted in film. We just take this kind of thing for granted and don't understand that this is a pioneering concept where, the depth of something has much more importance than just the material it's made out of. It's not Gundanium. It's not, unobtainium.
Yeah.
They may never know what it is, but the fact of the matter is it's buried down below the stuff that's much older than we think it should be.
To jump ahead a little bit, and Lydia, you kind of nailed it where you're talking about each part kind of has these specific sort of themes, where the first part was very much the discovery and the science of everything. And part two here that we get into, as they uncover more and more about this object, this is actually the part where we start pulling in and start at least hinting at some of the supernatural elements.
Oh, I love this part.
that play a larger role later on. But in part two is where it all starts forming.
I love this part. This is the creepy part where they start talking about Hob's Lane, and Hob was another name for the devil. And
exactly, yeah.
How people would hear these noises at night. Oh, I'm so creeped out even just talking about it.
Yeah, the Hammer version also has that scene.
Oh, good.
Now I have to watch the Hammer version because, okay, I won't get too much into it, but I love how they, this is what I was talking about, where they bring the science and they bring the spiritual or the supernatural and they kind of pull them together and they start talking about how it's interesting that these ape men, or I think they start talking about the potential of, I wish I could remember what they call them, kind of devil men. Well, gosh, they were little and they kind of looked the same and there were these noises and it kind of, and I think this is the part where Quatermass and the doctor go and they start researching the history in this area and finding out that, you know, supposedly there were devils and stuff like that going on. But I love that they take the science and they take the supernatural and they pull them together and they say, maybe the one is just a different name for the other. This is the part, I think, where that starts happening.
This is, again, like I said, you don't know any more than your characters do. And this is where it starts just sort of, you can just tell it's something in the back of Quatermass's head. It's just something's kind of scratching at the back of his head. He starts interviewing a couple of the people that have lived in the area for a long time. And they talk about this house that's just above the site. That's sort of, it's just in disrepair. It's being left to fall apart, and how there used to be all these hauntings and ghost sightings there and all the noises. And
that happens at my house.
Yeah, of course it does.
In the middle of the night.
So part two is very important for that. It just kind of sets the groundwork for things that's going to happen a little bit later. I mean, we're just kind of the speed things up a little bit here. They spend a little bit off screen, but they uncover this object. They pull in some excavation equipment. Colonel Breen does without the knowledge of Quatermass and Roni. And kind of destroy most of Roni's fossils in the process.
Yeah.
Again, talk about, you know, keeping the science real. Roni is lamenting, like, you know, they're just all piled up together. Where you're found is so important. He's so upset. And Breen, he doesn't know. He's like, hey, you got them, don't you? What? Quit complaining.
Well, and I love, too, the speculation that they come up with in this part. I'm using the speculation word too much. But where they decide, oh, well, this was a German bomb. Is this the part where they say it was filled with monkeys?
I don't think it was filled with monkeys. No,
it was a German, like a small plane or a small
Breen still thinks it's some sort of, it might be a V2, and someone else is like, what, filled with monkeys? You know, come on.
They're like, oh, they did it just to throw us off the track so that we stop focusing on the war effort. I got to think how to say this so I don't offend people. I love how that caricature of the military is, oh, no, it's just, it's perfectly explainable. Everything can always be explained in simple terms. In this particular case, it's of the military. But you definitely run into that caricature in other areas as well. But in this one, it kind of cracked me up.
You see, Quatermass, there's all this to be accounted for. It's not very likely to be solid.
A sealed compartment?
Well, it could be a number of things. A warhead, for example.
Or a German V weapon?
Well, it's a little more likely now, don't you think? Well, we'll assume that's what it is. Take routine precautions and get on with cracking the nut.
Quite a nut.
Well, as Lydia hinted at before, you know, now that they've got the object uncovered, there is an opening in the side, so they're actually able to go into this object. And within this object, they find another, what looks like a bulkhead that appears that it might be able to be opened. So they start hatching a plan to try to get in. There's no grip. There's no device. There's no, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? There's not a door handle.
There's no way in,
but they decide to go in and kind of clear things up and everything. And while one of the soldiers is down in the far end of the object, you hear this a blood curdling scream.
Potter, give me a hand inside.
Hold on, sir. It's as slippery as glass.
It was a kind of figure. It went through the wall.
He sees something. He sees a figure that goes through the wall, and it scares the, well, put it bluntly, scares the crap out of him. And that is the end of part two. Again, there is a lot that goes on. We really skimmed through part two. There is so much that goes on, and this is something. I mean, Barry, you were saying, "Oh, there's no way he's going to have me watch 3 hours." I'll tell you what, it does not feel like 3 hours. You burn through these things so quick because it is a very, despite the fact that there are so many scenes where it's just a couple of people sitting around discussing things, I think this thing moves. The pacing on this is incredible.
I agree. And I love it about this era and the BBC production during this time period. They don't, even though you have some exposition going on, like we mentioned, it's very political. It's arguing a very strong point, but you never have a point where you're just sitting there going, oh, when are they going to move on to the next scene? And I had that moment during The Walking Dead this week, okay, where I was like, oh, my Lord, I'm falling asleep. But during Quatermass in the Pit, you really don't run into that. If you're paying attention, you're listening and going, oh, that's kind of profound. It's interesting. It's a different concept, or maybe it's an old concept, but wow, that was something that was new back then. You run into the whole time that pacing, well, I hate to use the word pacing because Christopher already did, but you don't have lulls. You don't have a moment where people are just sitting around and you're going, okay, when are we getting on to the next scene? Because the scenes do move very quickly and there's such a load of information in this entire series. There's really no downtime.
Well, at part three, we get to the, you know, they're trying to kind of calm the soldier down, and he tries to describe what it is he saw.
All right, West, all right, pull yourself together, lad.
No, Sergeant. Give me a moment. Now, what did you see?
I don't know.
You said a figure.
He was little, like a dwarf.
A dwarf?
Crooked. Horrible. I don't know. Just horrible.
Was its head tucked underneath its arm?
Shut up. I didn't see it, sir. I did.
There were.
The figure was small, he said. Like a monkey or a dwarf. It seemed to cross the room and go through the wall.
What are you reading?
A newspaper report. The Hobbs Lane ghost, June the 1st, 1927.
What?
Now, did you know about that? Had you heard of it?
No. No, I never. 1927. They saw it then.
And then, like I said, they decided to go and try to open this bulkhead, so they send off for a public contractor with a special drill. I forget the type of metal that they need, but they needed something stronger than diamond, because nothing else seems to be able to...
Adamantium.
Yeah, it's adamantium, yeah. Vibranium.
It's vibranium.
And I think at this point, too, we do meet a reporter that gets kind of sent on the case. And I believe this character is actually a character that was introduced in the first Quatermass serial and then brought back for this one, although portrayed by a different actor. Just
a bit
of trivia there.
This character. Weirdly, I can't tell you why, but I do like that he's kind of the guy. It's kind of funny because he's sticking his nose in where it's not wanted. So when they're researching their articles from the 1600s where they're talking about, you know, people seeing devils and things like that, I think he walks in and says, what are you guys looking up? And you kind of have to wonder, why does he know that they're here?
But, well, I think at the first part, I think he just followed him. I think he picked him up at the dig and then just kind of, he kept tails on him and followed him.
And I feel like this is just my own little imagination, nothing at all to do with the actual program, but I feel like they could have made him like a a conflict for Judd where, you know, fit the officer and he could have been trying to get the girl, but never mind. Nope. Totally unrelated. Okay. Sorry. I'm just, you know, I'm a little romantic that way, but but I do like that he kind of, I'm torn with this. If you get to the fourth and fifth episodes on this one, the result of him is very, you kind of go, wait, why? Where did that come from? Wait, really?
Okay.
So I don't want to get into it because that's a little bit of a spoiler, but I did like this character. I kind of wanted him to get a little bit more involved than he did.
Well, in this episode, though, there is some important scenes that we need to discuss, and one of which they actually decide when they start doing the drilling. This was kind of important. They start the drilling, and at first nothing appears to happen. And then suddenly there's a very loud and, as it turns out, sickening noise that reverberates through the whole dig area. And apparently nothing does happen. The drill does not go through, but everyone is just completely thrown off. This sound is so disturbing that it actually is making people sick to their stomachs. And they're not sure what to do with it. Quatermass decides to run off along with Dr. Roney to research more about
the
area.
Like some of the singers on America's Got Talent.
What's that?
It's like some of the singers on America's Got Talent.
Yeah, exactly. There you go.
Sorry, guys. It was there. He runs off with Roney.
Yeah, he runs off with Roney to research more about the area while they kind of think about their next step on the object. And yes, I do learn that the disturbances date back hundreds of years, that these ghost stories.
Oh, no, see, I thought that happened in the second episode, but it happens in the third.
Yeah, this just starts in the third. They go back at least a couple hundred years where they can find the records of, like, the local church or something, I believe.
And I want to say it's the 1600s, so it's quite a while back. And they realize that Hobbs Lane has been the center of this activity for a long time.
Exactly. Colonel Breen, meanwhile, decides to go at it again with the drill. But before they can even start, they discover that there is a hole in the bulkhead. But it wasn't caused by the drill. It was bigger than the actual drill bit.
It wasn't there before.
It wasn't there before. And but something has sort of, it's melted its way, a hole has melted its way through the bulkhead and actually goes all the way through. And using this hole, they're able to actually get a purchase with a steel bar, and they're able to unscrew the bulkhead and get the hatch open. More strange and odd noises are heard and apparently felt throughout the area. And inside this compartment, well, I'm not going to tell you what's inside the compartment.
No. And I have this very clear mental image of it, too.
I know. Well, no, I'm not going to tell you. And that's, I think, where I'm going to start the synopsis. We can still discuss a little bit, and I'm sure there's a few points to bring up. But that's where I'm going to stop it. And because after this, part 4, 5, and 6, again, as much that as happens in 1, 2, and 3, I think twice as much happens in 4, 5, 6. So it'd be almost impossible to really discuss and go through.
We go 2 or 3 hours into this program talking about it.
Yes.
We're already like an hour in.
Yeah, exactly. There is just some fantastic stuff in this. And Barry, you were asking about the effects. I think the effects, particularly some that happen, I think it's at the end of part 4. Lydia, you could maybe verify, there is a scene with the ground kind of moving, which I thought was really effective and really freaky looking. That was done really well.
There are a lot of things, even to the point where there are some scratch marks on a wall. And I know that's kind of a funny thing to find, you know, you're creepy or intimidating, but it is. I think they did, especially for the time period, and considering the fact that most people were still on rations at this point in the UK, they did a really exceptional job getting their ideas across with a very, very limited budget. Everything from the object that they find through the skulls and through the area surrounding this dig site, it's very convincing. You don't see anything. You're not watching it going, oh, that looks totally fake. You're watching it going, oh, yeah, I totally get that. That's very believable.
There's even some moments with things kind of flying through the air and moving on their own volition that
you know what? Now that you mention that, that's exactly right. You're watching it going, oh, whoa. What? They did this back then?
Yeah, and it's all done very well. It is not the, oh, look, you can see the wires, you know, or anything.
I agree.
Or, oh, absolutely. It's just some guy off stage throwing things. You really
Wait,
don't
was
get that impression.
Off stage throwing? I didn't notice.
What's that?
I didn't notice guys off stage throwing
That's what I'm saying. You don't.
No, but I'm agreeing, but a little bit facetiously. But no, you're absolutely correct. There's nothing in this where, you know, it's not the cheesy BBC special effects that you kind of think of, you know, of taking place. It's actually, especially again from the time period, very well done.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and keep in mind too, this is really interesting. Now, I think most of the scenes where there are effects, like we're saying with the things moving on their on their own and that sort of stuff, was all filmed in studio and then and spliced in later. But a great many of the scenes of just the dialogue between the people, a lot of the other scenes were actually done live during broadcast.
That's amazing.
No way.
Yes. And then the other scenes were then spliced in during transmission. So it was done in a really interesting way.
That is interesting.
Mm-hmm. You know, as well as the effects in this serial, I have to think that there is some dialogue, and we've mentioned that there are scenes of just two people talking, but there are some dialogue that I think is fantastic. It's just snappy, intelligent, clever, some that are just funny.
I think it's in the fourth episode, so we're not allowed to talk about it, quote-unquote, but there's a part where Quatermass is, you know, commenting, he's saying, oh, this and this, and I could be this. And I think Colonel Breen says, what are you talking about? You're letting your imagination is running away with you. And Quatermass says, yes, isn't yours? And you go, well, yeah, you just dug up this thing, and it's got this weird stuff going on. Yeah, your imagination should be running away with you. But I love how practical he is about it. He's very British.
I got a kick out of the contractor that they had that was setting up the drill. That was saying, yeah, I did something like this once for somebody. It was a real, you know, hush hush job, big steel, you know, steel door and everything. Cut through it, no problem. You know,
and something about in a bank. I imagined a bank, even.
Exactly, and the colonel's like, glad you don't talk about it.
Yeah, exactly. there are comments like that throughout it that I just felt like it was brilliant saying, you know, your imagination is running away with you. Yes, it's yours. Like, there's something wrong with you if your brain isn't freaking out right now, because what is going on? None of us understand this, and you think this is normal? What's wrong with you? But no, there is some snappy dialogue. You're absolutely correct.
Well, I don't know. Where do we go from here? I think that's really about all. I don't know what else you can say. I mean, this is definitely something that I think you should go check out and see. And like I said, I mean, certainly, you know, you don't have to sit down and watch it all in a row. Although I think you're actually going to find it hard not to.
I don't think
to.
I did.
I would have loved to.
I agree. I think it's something where it's weird. It goes through these cycles where you think you know what's going on, and then they add something. And so, you know, as you go through the series, you kind of – and then at the end, I have to admit, at the end, I'm not going to talk about it. But at the end, I kind of went, whoa, like, I feel like I just got completely moved around in a circle. Wait, what? And not in a bad way, but in a surprised way for sure. So, I keep coming back to how I love that they mix that, the science fiction of it, and then also, you know, the supernatural of it. It's unique, I think. You don't see that a lot, and I don't know that I've ever seen it before this.
Well, I'll say two other things. One thing is that, you know, the art of the cliffhanger has been lost. This thing,
I agree.
This thing has some fantastic cliffhangers, and that's where I'm going to say, that's where I'm going to tell you that it's hard not to jump to that next episode if you don't have time or something, because
I walked away because it was the end of the time period where I could watch it.
Right, exactly.
But if I had been able to keep going, I would have.
Exactly. And the other thing that I found really interesting, and again, skipping to the end and without giving any real spoilers away or whatever, is that our quote-unquote hero doesn't save the day.
I appreciated that.
Yeah.
I was a little surprised, but I really appreciated that. And this is a BBCism, and not even a BBCism. Okay, we all know I'm a bit of an Anglophile. Yes, I love Jane Austen. We're so obsessed with heroes in this country that we've lost, or even anti-heroes, we've lost the fascination with the common man, with the person that's just subject to their circumstances. And I love that. I'll try not to get into it. But I feel like this is a great example of, you know, exposition on humanity and the state of who we are as just as people, you know, and there are some of us that are more exceptional than others, but most of us are just who we are. And I'm getting way too deep on this. This is wine philosophy speaking here, but a little Cabernet for everybody.
A little Cabernet philosophy. Yeah.
Cabernet philosophy. Okay. We're going to stop with that. But I do like that you see this more, it's not even an anti-hero, it's just kind of a more realistic and believable personality. And I think you see that in the series. Did I lose you guys?
Nope.
No.
Nope.
My screen just went completely white.
Oh, no.
Usually it goes black, so sorry. But I do enjoy that about this particular serial, where you don't have a guy who's just impervious to everything or who knows everything. You really are, like Christopher said earlier, you're in it with the character. You don't know any more than they do. And I think that's part of what makes this so captivating and makes you want to keep going from one episode to the next.
I'm curious to hear about the 67 film.
And this then is Barry's that- part. Barry, go.
Well, no, I really appreciate your synopsis, Christopher. I really do. And it was enjoyable to listen to, because I'm thinking, okay, because you said that's the end of part one. And I'm thinking, okay, that's like 10 minutes of my movie. And then you get to part two. I'm like, okay, that's like 35 minutes into my movie. So clearly there's a lot missing. Clearly I do need to check it out, because clearly I didn't see the right film. And by the way, just as a little aside, I've been a film professor for 8 years and a professional film critic for that amount of time. I've never seen the wrong film before, so this is the first to me.
Barry, you and Christopher both, and we have a couple of friends, Dave and some other guys. You guys make me sound like an idiot child. You know so much more than I do. You know, I feel like sometimes the only thing I bring to this is just enjoyment of the film. But no, you're absolutely right. You guys have been in so much, not longer, but more in depth than I have. I'm sorry, not to interrupt your film criticism.
No, you're great.
That's why I enjoy it. That's why I love talking.
No, Lydia, you bring a lot to the table too. And I guess really quickly to respond to what Christopher was saying, I mean, on the one hand, yes, I think the downfall, if you could even call it that, the problem with both the original version, apparently, and the version that I saw today by Hammer is, yes, it's very British, it's very dry, dialogue heavy at times.
Why is that a problem? You're talking to an Anglophile. British stuff.
Well, you know, obviously, I mean, the word, you know, obviously, we would say it's talky. It's you know, it's very, very dialogue driven. Yeah, and for some people that will totally lose, and that's why, you know, a lot of young people to use this example, a lot of young people don't care watching the original Star Trek because it's a lot of dialogue. There's not a lot of action. There's a lot of ideas here.
Yeah, realism is so powerful, though, and in a lot of things during this era, you just.
I'm in love with this era. Yeah, but to just address some things directly, in terms of the effects, let's mention that for just a second. Like, it's funny you mentioned the scene where objects are seemingly moving themselves. In the version that I saw, it was clearly a very big wind machine doing the work. So I think, in some regard, I think Hammer might have had kind of a limited budget on this film. But on the other hand, to very vaguely discuss a really wonderful scene, very vaguely, there's a scene in the movie involving, let's just say, something of a supernatural television transmission. And the way it's done in the 67 version, it's very eerie and very haunting and really intriguing. And, you know, even the moments in this movie where you can see, okay, they didn't have the budget for it, they didn't quite know how to visualize that, this film never runs out of ideas.
Yeah.
And I adore that because whether it's, you know, some of the recent films by Christopher Nolan or, you know, really crazy movies like John Dies at the End or, you know, Donnie Darko, you know, movies of recent that are just, it seems like they have so many ideas, the movie doesn't even have enough time to, you know, to fully portray all of them. I love this movie because for Pete's sake, it seems like even as they're wrapping things up, there's still all these crazy ideas and concepts that they're throwing at the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a thinking. It is very, until, like I said earlier, it's an intelligent story. It's a story that I think predates most any other science fiction that even comes close to hitting on these topics.
At least that I've seen, I agree.
Yeah, exactly. That I've seen, exactly. And I've seen a lot. So I'm thinking I'm not talking out – I'm not talking without some amount of intelligence.
Yeah.
No, you are. This is clearly a very influential film. I mean, even really quickly, even the scene we mentioned with the drilling of the extraterrestrial object – that scene has a really weird similarity to Arthur C. Clarke's 2001, where the spacemen encounter the rock object on the moon and it lets off a signal that is deafening. I mean, this is 10 years before that film came out. In fact, the version that I saw in 1967, that's 1 year before that movie came out.
Yeah, very interesting. I definitely think that, I mean, if you go sit down and watch this, and I'm guessing it's probably the same with the 67 film too, if you think you know what is going to happen, you are wrong.
I absolutely agree. There's no way. In this movie, at times I felt a little bit lost, probably partially due to the fact that I wasn't giving it 100% of my attention at some point. I have a tendency to multitask. Sorry, guys. Oh, now you know. My greatest downfall, but it went from, especially from one episode to the next, and things changed so dramatically because they threw in that little bit of information. You really go, oh, that's not what I expected. And it starts as early as them realizing that the object is at the same level as the skulls, which are up to 5 million years old. It starts from the first episode, and you just really don't know what's going to happen. I just reiterated what you said.
Yep.
Yay.
That's okay.
But you're right.
Awesome. That's usually my role. All right.
At least I agreed.
Well, I think that's all that's left is for us to kind of rate these, and I guess we'll go ahead and Barry, we'll let you rate the one you saw. Lydia and I will rate the serial that we watched. Who wants to go first?
I vote Barry.
All right, Barry.
All right.
This is your chance. Oh my gosh, Barry! This is your first Othel rating.
Barry, you haven't rated anything. Oh,
wow.
I'm excited.
Wow, 1 to 5, Barry. One is, you know, just go away. Don't bother. And 5.
I'm not gonna watch it again.
Yeah, 5 is the you can't go without seeing this.
You need to watch this in maybe 2 or 3 times.
Okay, well then I'd say on a scale of 1 to 5, I'll give it a solid 3, I think, because even for its limitations, there's a lot there, but clearly, from listening to your description, clearly there's a lot missing. Clearly, I think you guys saw the definitive take on this story. yeah, but I'd say a solid 3.
All right, very
good.
We saw
the longer one, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's true.
But now, I'm gonna insist, Christopher, I want to know what yours is.
Mine? I am going, this is going to be my first solid 5.
Wow.
Yeah,
I
this thing, the first time I saw it, just impressed the hell out of me. watching it a second time, it still impresses me. So yeah, absolutely. I think this is, I mean, if you're a fan of 50s television or film, if you're a science fiction fan, certainly that this is something that you can't not see this. It is so important. It is so influential. It is such it lays the foundation of so much that comes, and I think actually surpasses so much of what comes after it. It's just it's just way too incredible and important to miss.
Well, I think that's the first five you've given, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Wow.
Wow. Oh, all right. That's noteworthy.
So, Lydia, you're last. Let's see, what have you got?
Well, after hearing Christopher's argument, I have to give it an absolutely solid 4.
All right.
And the reason isn't because it's not exceptional for its era. It is exceptional for its era. You know, and honestly, Christopher, hearing your argument, I want to give it a 5. but I feel like it is. It's the foundation. It's a really good foundation for a lot of things that come afterwards. There are a couple of moments in it where, especially as it hops from one episode to the next, you kind of go, wait, what? I thought we were talking about this, and now we're talking about that. These are totally opposite ends of the spectrum, which is one of the things I love about it. But I'm gonna go with 4 because, you know what, if you don't like science fiction or you don't appreciate a classic, as we discussed last episode, I love classic movies. I love the black and white. And it's because it's intelligent. You know, and if you don't appreciate that, you're going to miss out on a lot of life. In fact, if you don't appreciate intelligent stuff, just stop listening to this podcast. but not because we're smart, but because, you know, we're going to run into some of that. But it's not my favorite. But at the same time, I think it is a great introduction to everything as it launched into the future and into the cosmos at this period of time when we stopped looking at other countries and we stopped looking at defending ourselves against invasion from this planet and started looking to the outside. And from that perspective, it's fantastic. And I feel like I'm running on again.
No, very little foot.
But I feel like this is one of those This is one of those mini series where if you're open to understanding where things started and where the questions started and where people started really examining, well, what if this and what if the impossible really were possible? This is fantastic. And, you know, if you're looking for something with solid writing and it flows really smoothly from one to the next, you're going to lack a little bit on this one. But when you're looking at something that really explores the beginnings of our fascination with what could be out there, this is a great one. So I'm going to 4.
All right, very good. Well, still, I think, you know, very honest and very good rating, I think. So, all right, gang. Well, thank you very much for listening. Please continue to download episodes of Orphan Entertainment. You can do that through our homepage at orphan-entertainment.johnja.net by looking us up on Stitcher Radio or subscribing through iTunes, where there you can give us a nice rating and leave a comment. We're being kind of blackmailed by a couple of our listeners that they want more creature features in our in our
yes!
discussions.
Please, I love creature films. You'll never shut me up.
Like we've been able to all year so
I
far.
I'm so sorry.
If you would like to blackmail us into a particular genre of film, you can do that by joining our Facebook page and leaving some comments there. Go to facebook.com/group/orphanentertainment.
Yeah, we absolutely read those, guys. Please, if you want to give us some feedback on that, or if you have an idea, please let us know.
Absolutely. Lydia, thank you very much. Always fun to hear your point of view on all these films.
I'm talking way too much tonight, but thank you.
And Barry, thank you so much. It was so awesome to have you back with us.
Yay.
Thank you. My pleasure as always.
And when we come back next month, hopefully you'll be able to join us, and hopefully we will be very sure that everyone gets a link or a description of the correct film.
Well, and next month is December, so I think we have to go with something Christmas themed.
Oh, boy, that's going to be tough. We'll have to try to dig something up.
We've already done
Santa Claus versus Conquers the Martians.
Oh,
so.
Gosh, yeah, we did.
We'll find something. But until then, I guess it'll be a surprise. You guys will have to come back and join us next month. Or actually, as soon as we discuss it, we'll have it up on our Facebook group. And here's something new, which we haven't mentioned yet, is we have an Orphan Entertainment YouTube channel where the films that we discuss will be easily available for you guys to watch. So I'm going to do my best to have things up there a week or two before we discuss it here on the podcast, so you get a chance to watch it yourself. So that's that. Okay, well, thanks, everybody. Lydia, Barry, thanks again. And
thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Yes.
That explains why I've been so confused. There's Alan Quatermain, and then there's Quatermass. And my whole life I've been – maybe I should say this while we're recording. My whole life I've been confused about this.
Oh,
I thought they were
people.
The same. No, I had no idea. I genuinely thought they were the same. There's your blooper. I really thought they were – I did. I thought they were the same. And
yeah,
I was like, how is Chuck Norris the same as this British guy? I don't get it.
Yeah, that'll be on the outtake in the end.
There you go. But it is true.